as we've just gone through it. So that's coming up for today. Let us consider, right? Let us think about, meditate, reflect on how we may spur one another, how we may motivate one another toward love, right? Agape, seeking nothing but the highest good of the other, right? And doing it, it's a tangible compassion and generosity for others, right? Not giving up meeting is the habit of some, but encouraging one another. And so as we have been back when Teresa, number of weeks ago, and then we had Sally and Rachel and Chris last week, and today Rock, hearing stories that I believe are will help to motivate us and encourage us toward love and good deeds. And so we all know Rock for the last 7 years or so, but I think today maybe
it's actually 5 years.
5 years. Okay. Because it was somewhere in the midst of
it. It was the end of March 2019.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we must have been a ways through the sermon back then. But anyway, yes.
Yeah.
Well, welcome. I'm glad you're here today.
Thank you.
So like we have with the others, let's just start off. Where were you born? Family, parents, siblings? Tell us a little bit about those early years.
Well, the existence for which I was assigned, I was plopped down in a very unique situation. I was born in March, beware the Ides of March, 1960. My mom and dad my dad was of Sicilian descent and my mom was of Irish descent. And my dad learned how to speak English when he got to first grade. And my mom was from a very broken, dysfunctional family, plagued with alcoholism and obesity. And my dad came, my grandfather came over from Sicily to work on railroads. He landed in Logansport, Indiana, which was the hub of the Pennsylvania Railroad. And to this day, half of Logansport is of Sicilian descent. Who knew? And it's about an hour north of Indianapolis. They retreated to Indianapolis when my dad was in high school. He went to Indianapolis Tech, which was the largest school in the nation at that time, and he graduated valedictorian. He got into Harvard and Chicago, and he wanted to go to the University of Chicago because it was only 2 hours away as opposed to Boston, which was 1,000 miles away. And he could send his laundry home to mom every month on the Pennsylvania Railroad. My dad had two older sisters, and then the fourth pregnancy, and you know, you got to understand, they were Sicilian, they were devout Catholics, and her job was to have babies and raise them. The fourth pregnancy went sideways. It was a partial birth, miscarriage. She ended up in the hospital in the early 20s in a state that really did not welcome minorities or immigrants. And the determination of the doctors at the time was to do a full hysterectomy instead of a DNC. And so my grandmother spent the rest of her life in dark rooms with migraines, saying that she was a tree that could bear no fruit. And my dad would sit there and hold her hand and say, "I'm going to fix you someday." So my father became a doctor. He went to the University of Chicago. He was Navy ROTC all the way through undergrad and medical school. He graduated by dumb luck. He graduated, he owed them a career. And he graduated in June of 45, and he was told to report to Pearl Harbor because while the European war was over, the Japanese war was not. And so he gets on a boat out of San Diego and finds out that he gets really seasick. And they choppered him over to a boat that was coming back, and they said, forget it. And they sent him back to the East Coast, and he read chest x-rays for the people who were being discharged from Europe for 18 months. He said all he did was this. He ended up back in Chicago, got his internship in pathology, and was hired by Indiana University, their first board-certified specialist ever. Interestingly enough, they were down on board certifications and specialties, and they said to him, we'll hire you, but you're doing time at the ER, you're going to deliver babies and do all that. You're not just going to run the lab. And so he said, you know, over the years, he's delivered 588 babies as the pathologist. So he met my mom in his last year of medical school. My mom was an early admission freshman, skipped her senior year of high school. She was brilliant. They say they had the same politics, I guess is the best way to put it. And as he had to report for duty, she said, well, I'll just come with you. And both families went, oh, no, you're not. And so they ended up going to get married. They went to the local parish in Hyde Park. And Hyde Park is Irish enclave. And the Irish priest basically said, I'm not going to bless this marriage. This is a darky Sicilian and a blonde blue-eyed Colleen. Nope. And so they went to the dean of students at the University of Chicago and had a civil ceremony. And my dad took it hard and never went back to the Catholic Church. So that's me. And mom and dad had five kids in 7 years, from 48 to 55. And so that's mom and dad. Angelo in the white shirt, he's the screenwriter, producer, director who did Hoosiers and Rudy. And the second one is Chris. He, in some ways, is famous in his own right. He is the third American and the first MD ever to climb Everest. He did medical research on the summit. He's one of the part of the 2020 club. He's climbed the 20 highest peaks in all the continents. And he's been a long-distance biker and runner for years. He was always in the top 10 as a long-distance runner, and he lives at altitude at 8,000 feet outside of Denver. And now his daughter, who went on a full ride to Michigan, a track scholarship, is doing these crazy 100-mile runs. I mean, she's insane. I don't know what they... But they have this ability, which was discovered on Everest, to create an enzyme that replaces oxygen on the hemoglobin. And so they can survive at hypoxic levels that most people can't. And it was the research done on Everest that eventually destroyed professional bicycling, because that's what they were doping on, was this enzyme. Sarah is the first daughter. She's a somewhat retired clinical psychologist in Manhattan Beach. Julie was a geophysicist, and by the way, Sarah and Julie and Fiora, the girls all went to the University of Chicago. Then that's me. And Seth, my little brother, got an engineering degree at New York Polytechnic, and got hired by the Navy to work in the radar jamming device at Naval Air Force. And when Clinton did the downsize and the buyout, he retired, went and got a master's in education, and he's been a high school computer guy ever since at Bloomington South High School. And he says his favorite class is the jock class, where all the football players and basketball players duck in there so they can get a good grade. Fiora is a licensed clinical social worker, went to Chicago and then UPenn, and still does one-on-one counseling to this day. She, for years, was in When You're About to Die, what's it called?
Hospice.
He did hospice care for 10 years and then finally just said, I can't do this anymore. It's too painful. My earliest memories are playing in the backyard with the older kids. I was their sort of mascot. Because 5 kids in 7 years, 1955 was the last one, and then I came in 1960. So it turns out that there was a fight, and the fight was between mom and dad about whether to have any more kids. They weren't Catholic, and, you know, and actually at that time, a little controversial, my dad, you know, Indiana University is a school of 30,000 students, and they make up the majority of Bloomington. Many of us forget that this whole abortion conflict really came about because the hospitals were desperate, and especially in university towns. Lots of girls were coming into the ER going, I tried to do this myself, it didn't work out, and they die. So my dad started to associate with an underground abortion clinic that was operating through a church. I always thought my mom was the one that wanted to have more kids, but it wasn't. It was my dad that wanted to have more kids. So I was due on leap year, and I was late as usual. And the closer it got to St. Patrick's Day, my mom started to say, maybe this is my Irish child. And so she was rushed in to the delivery room on the 15th. She gave birth to me at like, I don't know, 7 in the morning. And I came out with blonde hair and blue eyes. And my mom said, oh my God, this really is my Irish child. And so she named me Timothy Michael Sean Bartholomew Patrick Murphy Pizza. And it didn't fit on the birth certificate, so the nurse, by executive decision, cut the two middle names and left the pizza off. So for the first 9 years of my life, until I signed up for Little League Baseball, I was a Murphy. Besides the memories of playing with the older kids, unfortunately, the earliest memory I have is on April 1st, of all things. On April 1st, 1964, my sister was coming home. It was a half day of school. They were going on a spring break, and she was driven home by a friend, the mother of a friend. She was 9 years old, and she got out of the passenger side of the car, and I had made something for her in nursery school, because I was 4. And I was waiting for her at the end of the driveway, and she came around the back and she saw me and she said, oh, how sweet, and she didn't look. And she was struck by a car and killed. It really busted up our family badly. My mom disappeared for a long time. She apparently went to walk the Compostela in Spain, and when she came back, she just wasn't the same. So my brother is now filming in Bloomington his own story of his break from the family because of mom. So we were all successful. We were all compelled to study. I found research and academia very interesting and challenging. When I was a kid, I was a Civil War buff. I learned all I could about it. And one of the things I'll never forget learning was that Levi Coffin and his wife traveled from Cincinnati to go have a meeting with Abraham Lincoln. And several weeks later, Abraham Lincoln released the Emancipation Proclamation. So the Coffins are famous Quakers, and they were really leaders in Cincinnati of the Underground Railroad, and they funneled everybody to a place in Toronto. And I was really fascinated by this because while being a Civil War buff glorifies war, I also wanted to get into the origins of it, and I was like confused, how could this happen? I mean, I thought we had a constitution and it worked. It didn't really work, did it? And I started to see the reality of humanity, that it's flawed, it's imperfect, and while we would like it to be all ideal, it's not. By the time I was asked to commit to Christianity and baptize at 12, I was like, mm-mm, if the world's like this, how can I say what's real? So in the meantime, the 60s were a rough time for us. My brothers were both drafted. My mom and dad were delegates to the Chicago Convention, and Bobby Kennedy delegates. When I was born, they were JFK delegates. And I remember going to see Bobby Kennedy at his speech in Indianapolis on the day that Martin Luther King was killed. And Bobby Kennedy was told not to go, that there were 76 cities rioting after Martin Luther King's assassination, and they were afraid that Bobby was going to get killed and it was too dangerous. And he said, "But I don't represent them, I don't represent the country." So he went out and he quoted Aeschylus, which is on his tombstone to this day in Arlington. And I was part of, you know, thousands of people crying that day. A month later, Mom and Dad were having a victory celebration on the day of the California primary with about 100 delegates for Bobby in Indiana at our house. And we saw him say, on to the next primary. And 5 minutes later, he was assassinated. And I remember the overwhelming grief that I felt in that house that night. Mom and Dad were at the Chicago Convention when the riots happened. I thought they were going to die. It just sort of politicized me at an early age. My dad ran for state Congress. Became a state representative in 74. He was what they called the Watergate baby. It was a majority Republican district. And one of the big things that he did in his 2 years of service in the Indiana State Legislature is he attempted to pass a no public smoking bill, the first one in the country. And while it failed, I'll never forget being at the Indiana State Assembly when he gave a speech and he came out with two jars, a smoker's lung and a non-smoker's lung. And at the beginning, the Republicans all lit up because you could smoke in Congress, apparently back then. But by the end of his lecture, nobody was smoking. He continued that on. Bloomington was one of the first cities to ban public smoking. And now here we are today. It's passing all over the country. Growing up in a Big Ten university town, I was into sports. I went to all the IU games, football and basketball. In the 70s was the greatest team of all time. They're still the only undefeated team in the last 40 years. We were always terrible at football, but we're 7-0 this year. I played football and baseball all through high school. I got attention because we made it to the Babe Ruth World Series when we were 17. The Oakland A's signed me. I spent a couple years in California playing minor league baseball. When I saw that it wasn't going to work out, I applied to the University of Chicago. My sister Sarah was an admissions director, and she said, "You don't want to go here. There's gargoyles, it's cold, it's hyper-competitive, you're going to hate it." So I had known one of my mom's friends was a Quaker who had taken me to a couple of Quaker meetings, and she suggested that I look at Earlham College. So I did. I was the captain of the football and baseball team for all 4 years that I was there. We had one of the worst traditions in football in history. In fact, the Earlham College dropped their football program, I think, 7 or 8 years ago because they hadn't won a game in 10 years. So their last winning season was my senior year. And while that was fun and all, you know, it was controversial because Wilmington is a Quaker school outside of Cincinnati, and they call themselves the Fighting Quakers. But we were more adamant. Western Yearly Meeting, much more liberal, and they said, we're going to be called the Hustling Quakers. So I went to silent meetings. I started studying Quakerism sort of in an academic way. I was really enthralled by George Fox and what his message was, and, you know, to boil it down to its barest minimum, what attracted me was the egalitarianism of it. Just because I can't read the Latin doesn't mean I can't feel and sense the Word of God. And if you feel the light within, I can express the Word of God just as much as somebody who's studied Latin. Wow. Okay. I get it. And, you know, one of the most fascinating reads I've ever read was the Journal of George Fox, misspelled, poor punctuation, but he got the message across. And I ended up my senior year doing a semester abroad at the University of London. And one of the things I did while I was there was research for my professor, my Quakerism professor, the early Quaker press, because one of the things that George Fox did when he went around his pilgrimage to the villages is he would bring with him portable printers, and they would print pamphlets and run to the next town before the Star Chamber caught him. And I was like, wow, this is really the revolution of literacy in England. And if it hadn't been for the literacy, maybe Quakerism wouldn't have spread as it did. So I ended up getting a history degree. I believed, you know, from childhood, I believed you want to know yourself, you want to know your culture, you need to study your past. You can't know the present until you know the past. And so I wanted to be a high school history teacher. And my wife, Andrea, was a very experienced dancer. She did jazz and tap, and she worked in Reno and Vegas for a while, but she came back to Earlham to be with me, and at that time her father had terminal cancer and died at the age of 55 very quickly. And she, on his deathbed, said, I'm going to go enroll and finish my degree at your alma mater, which I didn't really even know because she was from Massachusetts. I met her when I went to prep school in Massachusetts. And I said, where's that? And she said, the University of Miami. What? So we went to the University of Miami when we were in our early 20s. And I taught for 5 years down there. One of the experiences I had when I was at the University of London, as I went back to find my roots and my Irish family, I went to Ireland before the semester started. I landed in a pub and with an American accent a few days before Christmas, and I ordered a Guinness, and they said, we don't serve Guinness down here, laddie, that's the north. We only serve Murphy's. And they said, what are you doing here? It's Christmas. You got an American accent. And I said, I'm here to find the family. And they said, what's the name? And I said, the name's Murphy. And he goes, half the county's named Murphy. You're going to have to do better than that. And so I said, the name's Charlie and Margaret. And they had 9 sons. And one of them was my grandfather, John James, JJ. And it was like, you could hear a pin drop. There were like 14 people in there. The banjo guy stops playing. Everybody's staring at me. And I'm like, uh-oh, what did I do? And some big guy from the other side comes over, puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says, you're the first one, Bachladi. I'm like, what? What's going on? Well, it found out that my great-grandfather, Charlie, was the leader of the IRA during the revolution in the 20s. He got caught smuggling guns and dynamite in with his sons on the beach. All the sons were deported. He was thrown in a British prison And that's why my grandfather ended up in Chicago, and they carried on the fight. So then I asked, well, what happened to Charlie after the treaty was signed and the war was over in 1924? And the guy said this. He said, ah, laddie, he just wasn't the same. And he says, and like all the Murphys, all you Murphys, the creature got him. And I said, creature? What are you talking about? I mean, I'd been told that their estate had magic healing powers because it was right next to a 3rd century monastery that was apparently christened by St. Patrick and all these stories. And I'm like, what creature? And he goes, the creature got him. Oh. And the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I didn't think I had a drinking problem, but I was the, you know, they didn't allow alcohol on the campus at Irwin College. So after my freshman year, I got off campus and I became the kegger every Saturday. And I still remember that moment because I had my own criticisms of my mom. My mom would, you know, viciously or vigorously say, I'm not an alcoholic, and yet go to the faculty parties on Saturdays and get ripped. If it hadn't been for my father being the coroner and the head pathologist and the chief of staff at the hospital, she probably would have had 6 or more DUIs, but they would just deliver her to dad instead. So I came back and I researched all the rest of the family, the other 8 guys that came to Chicago, and every one of those families they all died of cirrhosis. So that was a scare, and little did I know that I was headed to a disaster by going to Miami in the mid-1980s, where the cocaine trade was king. I'll just put it this way. I made it 5 years. I was disappointed with teaching, especially high school, because I cared and I wanted to teach them, but caring was not cool, and they really didn't care enough to try. And so I was like, gosh, you got 3 grade reading levels, you don't try, you're not, you know, you don't know, want to know who you are. And so I started to drink and use at it. I finally got in trouble with the school because I showed a video of Bill Moyers, The Constitution in Crisis, which is one of the best pieces he ever did. And he was essentially saying, how did we let the CIA take over foreign relations across the world and in Latin America? Well, several Cuban parents were very angry with me for showing that video. And so I felt rejected. I started using a lot more. The marriage was falling apart, which was a pattern. I was feeling alienated from her and everyone else and feeling sorry for myself. I landed in an inpatient rehab that my dad set up for me. He got me out of Florida. I never came back. When I sobered up, I decided that one of the most important things about our future would be the environment. And I had been politicized living in Colorado about the deterioration of the environment. So I found a place that gave a environmental law certificate so I could practice environmental law. And the number one environmental law program in the country is Lewis and Clark College. Back then, it was Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark College. So that's how I landed here. I stayed clean and sober for a couple of years. I remember being in that rehab, and they gave me the big book, and I started reading it. And the meat of it is the first 100 pages, and there's a chapter in there called We Agnostics. And he's basically saying anybody with addiction problems is probably agnostic. They don't have a higher power in their life, and they better or they're going to die. And I came back to the nurse's station and said, I'm not doing this. And therein began the battle between me and the AA program. I eventually, in order to become a member of the bar, because I got a DUI in my last semester of law school, I had to really take it on, and I had a man named Don Muchogrosso, which means very big or very fat in Italian. He was the head of the Oregon Attorney Assistance Program, and he really took me under his wing for 2 years, and he shepherded me through the 12 steps, and I know him like the back of my hand now. Long story short, I worked in Clackamas County for 6 years. I learned the art of the law, practice of criminal defense law, and eventually got a job in Columbia County as a full-time public defender. While I learned how to do trials, and you know, being a public defender actually is a lot more difficult than people would figure. And part of it is that all in life is politics, is it not? And when you come into the perspective of the criminal defendants against the state, there's a written presumption of innocence. But the fact of the matter, the system, the whole system itself, presumes guilt. And so to defeat it, you got a narrow place. Hey, they got the probable cause. They got enough to get you charged. How do you think you're going to get 12 people to buy into this? More and more, I realized that, and you know, we know the stats to this day, 1 in 30 cases in the federal courts go to trial. 90% of all the rest of the state cases end in a plea. Well, you know, people attributed that to poor law practice. Well, I was in it, in the trenches, for 25 years, and 90% go to pleas because 90% are guilty. And really, the best way to do this is say, how do we make this the best thing for you? How do we solve the problem that got you in trouble in the first place? And over and over and over again, I saw addiction, alcoholism, and mental illness. And it was just painful to watch and to know that you're going to get punished for what you did. And I get that. But is there a way to make this not happen again? And the more I started to feel this way, and especially because half of my practice was dependency law, where kids are taken away from their parents because of usually their addictions. How do we make this work out? Well, for the last 30-some years, there's been a movement in the criminal justice system to drug court. And in drug court, the theory is, hey, if you acknowledge that you blew it, then put you through a rigorous recovery program for a year. You got to plead guilty up front so that if you blow out of it, you go to jail. But if you don't, hey, you never do the time, you never get the conviction, and you can move on and stay clean and sober. Well, that became my major advocacy. And for the last 7 years of my practice, that's all I did. And especially for moms in dependency court. And, you know, I was practicing law, but really all I was doing was recovery work. And there were so many things that I found parallel in my life because I'd gotten clean and sober, and with 20 years under my belt of sobriety, I knew the steps like the back of my hand. And I would really focus them on the first four steps. The fourth step is really the kicker, because the fourth step is a searching, fearless, personal moral inventory. And the method is identify your resentments. Well, who is it that you resent? What is it that they did that you resent? What did they do? And then the fourth part of the fourth step is, what was your role in creating this resentment? And so I realized that, and I would say of the 25 years I practiced law, every day I would have this, why didn't I study psychology in undergrad? But I came to a place where I acknowledged that really studying history is, in many ways, studying the psychology of the past. And this became my advocacy. In the meantime, I was growing apart from my wife, and the kids were growing up, and I was feeling more and more alienated. And there were things that would, like, if you were in trouble in St. Helens, Oregon, and you needed to get out of trouble and were willing to get into recovery, you'd come to me. I'd take you to your first meeting. I'd introduce you to a sponsor, and it's time to get clean and sober. But sometimes when I would go to the meetings, I did his divorce, and I did her DUI, and I'd see people pop up and leave the meetings. And I'm like, oh, well, it's more important for them to be there than me. And so I stopped going to the meetings, and I came to a place where I really was just a shell of who I was, and I was talking the talk and walking the walk, but I was gone. And let me read this, because this is something I said to many of my clients, and what I didn't realize was I wasn't living this myself. So this is a great book. It's called A New Earth, from Jesus' reflection that if you have faith, you'll find a new heaven and a new earth. And also say, Joseph Campbell, who did The Power of Now just before he died, he said there were two great Buddhists, the Buddha himself and Jesus. And this is page 199. Is that so? The Zen master Hakuin lived in a town in Japan. He was held in high regard, and many people came to him for spiritual teaching. And then it happened that the teenage daughter of his next-door neighbor became pregnant. When being questioned by her angry and scolding parents as to the identity of the father, she finally told them that Hakuin, the Zen master, was the father. In great anger, the parents rushed over to Hakuin and told him with much shouting and accusing that their daughter had confessed that he was the father. All he replied was, "Is that so?" News of the scandal spread throughout the town and beyond. The master lost his reputation. This did not trouble him. Nobody came to see him anymore. He remained unmoved. When the child was born, the parents brought the baby to Hakuin. "You are the father, so you look after him." The master took loving care of the child. A year later, the mother remorsefully confessed to her parents that the real father of the child was the young man who worked at the butcher. In great distress, they went to see Hakuin to apologize and ask for forgiveness. "We're really sorry. We've come to take the baby back. Our daughter confessed that you're not the father after all." "Is that so?" is all he said, and he handed the baby over to them. The master responds to falsehood and truth, to bad news and good news, in exactly the same way. "Is that so?" and allows the form of the moments, good or bad, to be as it is, and so does not become a participant in human drama. To him, there's only this moment, and this moment is as it is. Events are not personalized. He's nobody's victim. He's completely at one with what happens, and that one who happens has no power over him anymore. Only if you resist what happens are you at the mercy of what happens, and the world will determine your happiness and unhappiness. The baby is looked after with loving care. Bad turns into good through the power of non-resistance. Always responding to what the present moment requires, he lets go of the baby when it's time to do so. Imagine briefly how the ego would have reacted during the various stages of the unfolding of these events. I ended up having my office raided, and they found drugs in my office. I was prosecuted. I went to an inpatient treatment clinic for 3 months, and ultimately that didn't work out. And I relapsed while I was on probation at the very end in March of 2019. My house was foreclosed. I was getting kicked out of my house. I had nowhere to go. And complicated story, I didn't do the aftercare from my inpatient treatment because I wasn't a Multnomah County resident. So I had landed in the streets of Multnomah County in my car and was set to begin inpatient treatment in the last week of March. That weekend, I knew I couldn't stop, and I was scared because this was going to go down badly, and I was so ashamed and humiliated. I had been suspended by the Oregon State Bar. I had nothing left. My children wouldn't talk to me. My brothers and sisters wouldn't talk to me. I'd lost everything, and I knew that I was going to show up on Monday, and they were going to drug test me, and I was going to test positive. So that Sunday, I had been nicknamed in the past Rocky Butte, named after the Rocky Butte, and I went to Rocky Butte, and the original intent was to drive off the cliff, but I figured the kids would want the car. So I parked the car, and I went to the ledge, and I kneeled to spring off the edge, and right when I kneeled, there was a gust of wind, and I thought, never going to feel that again. And I dropped to my knees, and I remember just not hearing a voice, but just feeling, not now. Not now, take your lumps. So I went the next day, and I tested positive, and he started finger wagging me, and who do you think you are? And so I had another session on Thursday that I knew I was going to get drug tested for. And I was like, how am I going to do this? Because I know, as being a drug court attorney, I know how long it lasts in your body and when you're going to test positive and when not. And so I said, how am I going to stay clean for the next 4 days? I don't know how I'm going to do this. And I had an electric car that I could plug in for free at two places, Bridgeport and Washington Square. So Bridgeport security was sick of me hanging around there, and so I decided I was going to retreat to Washington Square. So quickest way to Washington Square from Bridgeport is on this road. I made the turn. I'd never been on this road before, and I saw the sign, and it said Friends, and I said, I know what Friends means, and it was just this, maybe I'll feel something, the light, something here. So I saw that it said service at 10 o'clock, and so I was going to be there. In the meantime, I tested negative on Thursday, so they didn't kick me out. But on that day, I saw this film that in many ways I'm angry with all my training in drug court and with Serenity Lane, who had me for 90 days inpatient. They never showed me this movie. But this movie is called Pleasure Unwoven. And it's an hour and a half long documentary. I urge you to see it. And it was done by a Navy doctor who ended up in an inpatient rehab. And the Navy's really cool about it. As long as if you're having a bad time with drugs and alcohol, even if you're flying planes, You put you in rehab, and if you, we'll get you back in a plane or a boat as soon as we can. And he said, he's sitting there, and they're talking that about this being a disease. And he's like, this isn't a disease. This is a moral failing. I mean, I'm the one who screwed up. I'm the one who's, you know, drinking out of control. It's not a disease. And so he said he was going to take them on. And he said, little did he know that he was opening up one of the biggest controversies in modern medicine. And what he said was something that's like, why didn't somebody tell me this before? The modern definition of addiction is that it is a mental illness in 10% of the population that when confronted with major life stressors, like, I'd never heard that before. Instead of using logic and reason in our prefrontal cortex to solve those problems, instead, our reptilian brain cycles us back into this, no, there's only one way out of this intense emotional pain, and that's to numb out. What? Why didn't somebody tell me this before? And it really just changed everything. So here I was, that is in my head. I'm thinking, oh my God, I got a whole 7 days. And I show up here. And Don's talking about the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm still so mad at my ex-wife and my mom and all the people that did this to me and who, you know, this is all your fault. And he's talking about 70 times 7. I'm like, yeah, I know that line. And I said, I've said many times, you know, mom did me wrong 490 times, now what, right? But he said it in a logical, methodical, and compassionate way that I will never forget. And as Retha puts it, I sat over there in the third from the back row, and I sobbed. And it's been so hard for me to say yes to faith and belief. But ever since that day, I think about the woman who bleeds. And I think about the power of that story. She only touched him on the robe, the back of the robe, and he stops and he says, who touched me? And he sees her and he says, because of your faith, you're healed. And so Don has given me this place where I may not be a perfect Christian, but I certainly am a Jesus follower. How does he get that place of love and compassion that seems to have never happened before or since? How does he heal in a place where there's no judgment and there's no grief? And it's been 5.5 years now, and God bless. I'm clean and sober this time. And I may have lost my voice professionally. I may have lost a lot of options professionally. I'm a felon. Possession. Which, you know, in my soapbox, I'll say, this is not right to make felons out of addicts. Because once you're a felon, there's 9 out of 10 jobs you can't have. With that being said, I understand, I get it, I accept my fate, but I also thank Don quietly every day of my life because he gave me a path to accept Jesus into my life and accept myself. So thanks, run the rest of the pictures and I'll show you my... That's my son and my daughter who have let me back in their life. He's a senior at the U of O and getting a mathematics degree. She has two cute little babies that I take care of all the time, and she's a paraeducator at a middle school in Beaverton. And she's working on her special ed degree right now through the assistance of the public school system. Keep going. That's my mom and dad. Dad passed away in 2014. Mom, just 2 years ago. I tried to make my peace. My mom's gift to me before she died was her Bible. That's my symbolic picture. That was the Keller Auditorium where they were doing the Book of Mormon. And this is before the show, so I stood up and my daughter took a picture of me. And this is the gang now. This is the clan. There's seven of us. There's 16 grandkids. It's a wild party. And that is the seven of us just a few months ago at our last reunion in August, in July. And you can see why they're all concerned about my health. So that's me and Fiora and Angelo and Sarah, Chris, Seth, and Julie.
Thank you, Rock.
So thank you, Don.
I appreciate you being vulnerable and sharing today.
I don't know if I have a membership card, but I still keep coming.
Good. Thank you. I really appreciate your sharing. Yeah. And as we always say, you know, take what you heard today, what inspires you, motivates you, take it out into the world for good. Love and good deeds.